Really, the big goal is learning that. The second step we help with is becoming financially solvent. And then once someone's got that foundation, then starting to achieve greater financial freedom with one of the end goals of financial independence, not having to trade time for money anymore.
Welcome to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Are you trying to get out of debt, invest, or just not sure where to start? Then this is the place for you. We discuss different ways to get out of the rat race and build your wealth. Join us on this wild ride to financial freedom.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cavagione, and today's guest is Jerry Fetta. So Jerry and I were talking a little bit before we hit the record button. I understand he's down in Florida enjoying that sunny weather, and I'm enjoying the sunny weather out here in Eva Beach, Hawaii. So we kind of had something to bond over really quick. Hey, Jerry, just looking at your background, it's super exciting to have someone like you on the show and share your story and what you're doing. So thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Mike. By the way, I used to live in Alaska, believe it or not. Oh, wow. I've had the extreme colds and the extreme hots now.
Wow. Yeah, definitely. You know what? Let's get into that. Let's talk about that a little bit. Having you come on the show, I'm going to ask you the same question I ask everybody that first comes on. And we want to know a little bit more about you. So if you could share your story, how everything got started for you, definitely want to know how you went from Alaska to Florida. It's two different sides of the world, pretty much. How did you wind up in Florida and how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, we moved to Florida about a year ago. Just to backtrack, some of my company, Wealth Dynamics, I've been in the financial industry for about a decade now. And it's actually what I started doing at 18. I was a personal trainer and a bodybuilder for a little while. I transitioned into finances. And I saw a lot of parallels. That's what I liked with that. Earn more than you spend, burn more calories than you consume, like similar parallels. And so I did that for many years in Alaska. And that's where I grew up. I lived there for about 20 years. And as I grew my business, I started, especially in today's day and age, getting a lot more digital. And so we were able to start really being more of a cloud-based interface. So I was in Los Angeles in early 2020, doing some work and seeing some clients down there, and literally right when COVID had hit. So we got stuck in LA for a year, and we were just intending on visiting for a little while. We were stuck there for a year. And then during that year, we realized that we don't need to go back to Alaska. We can run this business from anywhere. It's one of the benefits of passive income and residual income and having an online business is you can do it from your laptop and there's a lot of freedom. So we just thought about where would we like to go? And Florida was what came to mind. And that's when we moved over about a year ago. And we've been here since, just enjoying the sunshine and growing our company down here.
Oh, right on, man. That is like the ideal way to do things. That's the whole idea behind building passive income and building your wealth, is so you can have that freedom to do things like that. And I think that's the biggest goal for most people, is that they want to have that freedom to be able to live where they want and be able to just live this life of enjoyment and fulfillment and not have to worry about, can I put food on the table at night? So that's pretty awesome, man. Now, what is it that you currently do in your own personal financial freedom journey? I know you said you run Wealth Dynamics, right? So what is it? So is that company still Alaska based, or has it moved to Florida with you?
So it's still an Alaska-based LLC, and we've got an expansion and an LLC now in Florida as well. But our staff are all here in Florida. We've got some throughout the United States. So we don't have anyone in Alaska now but clients. And so that's our main headquarters, I would say, is in Florida. And the main thing that we do is we help families and individuals, you know, number one, become financially educated and financially literate, but with the real truth about money. When I was a financial advisor, there's one side of finances that you learn that's on CNBC, and you're going to hear from all the financial professionals and experts. And then there's what the wealthy actually do. And so for me, that was a hard learning curve on learning it the retail way, is what I call it, mainstream, and then figuring out behind the scenes what actually happens and realizing that those aren't the same thing. So we teach clients and families that. And really the big goal is learning that. The second step we help with is becoming financially solvent. And then once someone's got that foundation, then starting to achieve greater financial freedom with one of the end goals of financial independence, not having to trade time for money anymore.
I absolutely love that and respect that. That is exactly what we're trying to do here with Average Joe Finances as well, is promote financial literacy and show people that there are so many different ways for you to build your wealth and get yourself out of that rat race. So that's awesome, man. So I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because you had mentioned like you have the mainstream way and then you have like the behind the scenes, like what's really going on. And I would say that I would argue that that's, hey, this is what the top 1% do. So how does somebody build wealth like the top 1%?
So that's a great question. And there's a lot that goes into that. So again, I was a mainstream financial advisor when I first got started. And I did that for many years. I was endorsed by Dave Ramsey. We were in like 8 different states at that time. And so I was very ingrained in the retail or mainstream method of put everything in a retirement account and buy your mutual funds. And hopefully when you're 60, you've got enough there and you've paid off all your debt. And what I noticed was when I looked at certain wealthy people, they didn't have anything to do with that system. You know, like they weren't interested in the financial products and the mutual funds, but they were doing something else. And so I had to start looking and pulling that string on, okay, well, what are these people doing? And so for me, when I started looking at, okay, what do the wealthy actually do? The best thing I was able to do is just go study their biographies. And so I started reading biographies on guys, John Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, JP Morgan, some of these big historical names in finances. And I started seeing a lot of commonalities. And one of those commonalities was they might have owned banks and Wall Street firms, but they didn't use those products and services themselves. They offered it to other people. They did other things entirely. And that was where I started my trail on, okay, what do I need to be doing? And what does the average person need to be doing?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's actually, so I'm doing something myself right now. So I'm sure you know what velocity banking is, but I'm doing that right now. I basically turned my home into my own bank and I utilize a HELOC to pay off debt, yeah. Pay down my mortgage a little earlier. And I've even used it to invest in some syndications as well. So there's this versatile use that I have with it, which has just been pretty awesome. I would have never thought to do something like this if I would have stuck with this mainstream way of thinking that, oh, I need to save up this money and then I need to invest it into some index funds and something safe so that I can retire when I'm 65. Man, 65, that's too old for me, man. I need to reach financial independence way before that. So what are some ways to do that? And that's when I started looking into all these different alternative methods of wealth building. Can we talk about that a little bit? Yeah. What are some strategies that you focus on now? Because, you know, when you said you were endorsed by Dave Ramsey back in the day, then, you know, that kind of, this is like two different worlds, right? Because he's all about, hey, pay off debt, stay out of debt, stay away from debt, and that's it. So it sounds like you're on the other side of the fence now where you utilize debt as a way to mitigate and use it or leverage it right to your advantage. Can you share with us like some of the strategies that you do?
Yeah, for sure. So it really is, you've got the Star Wars stuff in the background. It's like going to the dark side, going from Dave over to the dark side of the Force.
I love it. You know, I love it.
Exactly. So I did a lot of that stuff for many years. The strategies that I use now are, they almost all fly in the face of that. And it's not even intentional where it's like, hey, I'm intentionally going to do opposite of all the things I learned. It was, again, studying and seeing this is actually what the wealthy are doing. So one of the big concepts that I use is actually, ironically, using whole life insurance as a bank. But back in my Dave days, the whole life insurance was the devil. If you've ever seen Waterboy, Mama says whole life insurance. Dave says whole life insurance is the devil.
It's like foosball.
Exactly. So I use that regularly now. I do a lot of investing for passive income. I'm very big on private lending and seller finance. But again, so when I look at the wealthy, some of the wealthiest out there are banks and bankers. And so I just look at how many loans do they have out there? And those are all truly passive income sources. And so I'm really big on that. I love the HELOC strategy. I also do a lot of buying gold and silver. Similarly, you can collateralize that as an asset and borrow against that too. And so I'm always looking at A, I want to earn a lot of income. B, I want to store it in real assets, real stores of value. But C, if I can, I want to collateralize against those assets and invest those in immediate, truly passive income sources. So I can double dip. I want to earn interest on the store of value, the asset, and also the thing I'm investing for, and not have to pay the taxes on that loan.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And a great way to look at it too. I love the term that you use there, right? Where you double dip. And I know a lot of people that do the infinite banking strategy with life insurance. And that's one of the beautiful things about being able to borrow from this policy while it's still gaining interest and invest that money into another cash flow producing asset that's going to create more passive income. And now you get that double dip effect, which is just absolutely awesome, man. Now, I'm curious because I haven't heard too much about people doing that with gold and silver. So you're buying like actual physical assets of gold and silver and then borrowing against that? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So this was one that was, it's a very similar concept. When I was starting to research, what do the wealthy do? One of the stats that I saw was that the United States Central Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, they still own like the majority of the gold in the entire globe. So they have almost half a trillion dollars worth of gold. It's about 216 million ounces. And so they have that as a store of value. They do things like leasing it out to others. And so when I started looking at this, I realized you can actually borrow against gold. You can do a collateralized loan. There's certain banks you've got to do this with, but you can usually borrow about 75% of your value. The interest is very similar to the life insurance. It's about 5 or 6% interest. Over the long haul, I know my gold is going to appreciate at 8 to 10% a year. It's been doing that since the 1970s when it became legal to own again. So I can really do that same arbitrage play, borrow against the gold. And what I like to do is when I do that deal, so I borrow against it and I invest it for passive income, I'm usually going to save that passive income anyways, right? And I'm going to accrue it until I can do another investment. So I go ahead and I deleverage. I pay my line of credit directly, like a checking account. And then it pulls that loan value down. The gold appreciates, and then I can do another deal that much faster.
That's like exactly what I'm doing with the HELOC right now too, which is awesome.
Yeah, same concept. So yeah, I call those tier two and tier three. It's the tier one is the life insurance, tier two is the gold, and tier three is the HELOC.
Yeah, that's awesome. So with gold, and you're saying like most of the lenders that will do it for you, they say it's around 75% of the value of the gold. But the funny thing is, like when you look at other ways, like I know M1 Finance will let you borrow against your paper assets that you have in stocks. And I think they let you go up to 80%. Oh, no, maybe it's less than that. Maybe it's 60%. So you have a 40% buffer. But when you think about it, if you could borrow up to 75% of the value of what you have in gold, that you still have that 25% buffer. And I can't remember the last time I've seen gold really drop in value 25%. So it keeps you in a pretty safe spot that if something was to happen, that you can always cash that out if you needed to. So that's a pretty interesting way to do it versus, for example, like the way I'm doing it with the HELOC, my home can go down in value. It's not likely that it's going to be something crazy like 2008, but it's very possible that it can go down in value. Sure. So it depends on how safe you want to be. So I only took out maybe 1/4 of what I was eligible to take out when it comes to the equity on my home. It's just one of those things. I wanted to play it safe, but at the same time, it gave me enough that I could do what I wanted to do with it. So it's very interesting that with gold, they'll let you do 75%. Now, you had mentioned silver as well. So is silver more of a, you're just buying and holding silver? Because the way I look at it, silver in the future might be, well, not be worth more than gold, but the uses for silver outweigh the uses for gold. Gold is nice. It's for jewelry. You don't see it too much in technology. Silver is used for so many things because of it's very good. It's a very good conductor of electricity, right? So you see it in a lot of phones and other electronics and things like that. Where do you see using silver as a hedge against inflation?
Yeah, that's a great point. So I do own a little bit of silver. So when I'm borrowing against assets, there's three key metrics that I look at. The first one is against the asset I'm borrowing against itself. What's the compounding annual growth rate? So that's going to tell me on average, what can I expect? The other stat that I look at is the standard deviation, right? So how far above or below that average number could the pendulum swing? And then the third one is called the max drawdown. What's the worst year it's ever had? And so gold and silver, you can both borrow against same loan to value, 75%. The compounding annual growth rate is very similar. They're both between 8 and 10% over the long term. And I tell people, if you're going to buy these, if you're not going to hold them for 5 years, don't even do this. There's just too much cost involved, and it's a real physical thing that you want to hold on to for a while. The standard deviation on silver is where the main difference happens. It's got about a 25% standard deviation, whereas gold is only about 15. And that means if I borrow, my margin call risk is a lot higher. If it drops down, and my loan is now a higher number than my actual value, I've either got to buy more silver or I've got to pay that loan down in order to get it corrected. And so there's more risk of that with silver. So I like silver as a hedge. It does have the benefit of that deviation is the upswing is the same, right? So silver could go from 20 to 48 an ounce, and it's going to double in some cases like that. And I could take advantage of that. With gold, we're not going to see it in a year go from 2000 to 4000. It's going to be a slower, more steady increase. So that's where I see that. But one unique thing that I didn't know until I started studying this years ago, silver is actually a byproduct of gold mining. So you can't have silver without first mining gold. It's with milk, you get whey from milk. And so that's the same kind of refining process. Silver comes out of that refining process. So they're going to go hand in hand. But the big thing I look at there is even just as a store of value, Mike, there's only enough gold in existence for everyone on the planet to own 1 ounce. There's only enough silver in existence for everyone on the planet to own 8 ounces. That just shows you the scarcity behind both of those assets. And like you said, the uses continue to grow. I just saw an article the other day, they're using gold to cure cancer now. If you inject the cancer cells with gold, it kills it off like chemo does without any of the risks of chemo. But silver, Tesla is going to be using a ton of silver for their cars. So the demand is definitely there.
Yeah, that's a great point. I had no idea that gold could possibly have some type of medicinal properties to it, man. That's mind blowing, Jerry.
It is. And they use it for that. And they use it for dentistry for a long time too. Gold fillings and different things.
Definitely seen that before. I grew up in New York, man, for sure. I saw gold fillings and gold teeth all the time, for sure. Yeah. Oh, right on, man. That is so cool. I had no idea. And yeah, definitely silver for sure with electric cars, not just Tesla, but just electric EVs in general. Mm-hmm. And they're also now with hydrofuel cells that they're trying to work on, which is going to be another way, but they need to be able to conduct electricity really well with that. And what's going to be needed for that is silver. So if you look at a lot of the emerging technologies and just the different things that are happening, there's so many requirements for these finite resources like gold and silver. Like you said, once you use it all, that's it. I've heard of in the future that the possibility of space exploration to go mine gold and silver off of asteroids because they discovered a lot of them do have those same minerals, Earth quality minerals on those. But I think we're a pretty long way from that unless Elon Musk gets his way and then we'll be on Mars in a couple weeks.
The irony behind that, and no pun intended, is that in order to go to space, the sheathing that they put on the outside of the astronauts' masks is actually made out of gold. So you can't go to space without gold. You have to have that to go to space to get the gold or get the silver.
See, that's all interesting stuff, man. Definitely. It's the things that you don't think about that are tied so closely to these precious minerals and resources that we have. So I want to touch on something else that involves the top 1%. And it was one of the topics that you had listed for us to discuss. This one might be a little triggering for some people, but at the same time, I think it's a very important thing to understand and to know because this is something I use as a strategy as well. But how do you go about not paying taxes or paying very little taxes? I know that's one of the topics that you wanted to discuss. And I definitely want to touch a little bit more on this because the stuff that we talked about, there is some tax mitigating there, but not as much as what I would say you would get in real estate. So I wanted to see where your mind was at with that.
Yeah, that's a great topic. So like you said, it can be a little bit triggering. We're in an environment where we have a group that's saying, hey, we need higher taxes. And then we've got another group saying, hey, no, let's lower it or let's leave it alone. And you really have to take a step back and you have to look at the tax code. So we have, if we were to put this on like a chart, we have the US Treasury, which is the federal government. And then we've got the IRS, which is like their collection agency. And then we've got the Federal Reserve Bank. And the tax system, a lot of the income tax that we get actually goes to service those loans, to pay our debt, to pay the interest on that debt. Very little of it goes to things that we think it would go to, like roads and different things, schools, et cetera. A lot of it's interest on debt. There might be there's a lot of war expenses. That's usually a big one and different costs associated. But the tax code itself is really what we have to look at. So the code, if you look at just code, not like the case notes and different things, there's, I believe, 6,000 or 7,000 pages of just straight code. And so that's the entirety of the tax code. Only about 0.50% of that has to do with the paying of income tax. There's only 50 or 60 pages that say, here's what you've got to pay, which means the rest of the code is clarifications on ways not to pay taxes, which is very interesting because we think about taxes, we're like, why would there be a code and the majority of it is ways to not pay? And then you have to look at who wrote the code, right? So the Internal Revenue Code, it gets passed by Congress. If you look at the net worth of most Congress members, many of them are in the top 1%. And then the other people that influence the Internal Revenue Code is actually lobbyists, and lobbyists work for giant corporations. So the top two groups that influence what's in the tax code are in the top 1%. They're incentivized to not have to pay taxes on all of their assets and all of their wealth. So the thing that I tell people is it's a knowledge thing. I can feel triggered by it, or I could be like, okay, it's there. I just don't know something. There's things in there that other people know that I don't know yet. I need to find either a professional that can help me, or I need to dive into that code and figure it out. And that's it. There's thousands of ways not to pay taxes, and it's all in that code. It's all legal. And it's mind-blowing when you see some of the stuff out there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I recently was just audited by the IRS. It was actually on my 2020 tax return. And yeah.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Yeah. But the thing was, and I didn't expect this, but they actually owed me money. And they sent me a letter in the mail and said, hey, we reviewed blah, 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 blah. You paid this much. You really should have paid this much. So we owe you $2,600. So I'm like, what? And next thing I know, like literally a couple days after I got the letter in the mail, I got a check. And I'm like, okay, I thought I was going to get a letter saying I owed them more money. So it was very interesting, not what I expected. But the thing is, it's funny because it was something I missed with one of my properties, something I guess I forgot to claim or something. Because for the longest time, I've been doing this myself. And like this year, I'm hiring a CPA because it is just too complicated for me at this point. But it was little things like that, just things from the tax code that I was able to benefit from, such as owning real estate and being able to claim some of the depreciation on different parts of the real estate that I own. And now investing in multifamily assets, I get to get this advanced depreciation with these cost segregation studies, which really help and really help you take a huge loss. It's the little things like that. I get it. Some people are like, hey, that's not cool. You're not paying your fair share. But really, you are, because when you're buying these assets and you're buying like real estate or other things like that, you're creating jobs, you're creating a livable area for people, affordable housing, and then making it so that those tax dollars are still getting put into the system. So there's little things like that. Trust me, I'm paying my fair share. And it's just something I wanted to touch on a little bit, because like you said, you've got these two opposing sides that are making these arguments about why people should pay more, why we should leave it the same, or why people should pay less. It's very interesting when you look at the tax code, like you said, and there's more clarification in there to help you pay less in taxes than there are saying, here's what you actually need to pay based on the bracket that you're in. So it's wild. And I think it all has to go back to your mindset. And I think that's where you go, your focus is when you're talking to people about this, but building their financial literacy and understanding these things is changing your mindset, changing the way that you look at this. Because if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have never looked at it this way. I would have never thought I could save money in my taxes because I bought some properties. You know what I'm saying? Things like that are interesting. And I'm glad that you're out there putting out this information and sharing this with people so that they can get a better understanding themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Thank you. And a big thing to add to that mindset too is when the government creates a tax code that gives you an incentive, you know, it's either because A, they want to use it themselves or got lobbied in, or B, it's their way of outsourcing, right? Like they're looking at it and saying, okay, we could turn this into a government agency to create more housing, right? Or we could give a tax benefit to the investor and have them do it. And then they create more housing, or they create more jobs, or they invest in oil and gas or electric vehicles or solar. And so we're going to incentivize them to do it by giving them tax breaks. And it's like their way of then hiring and outsourcing that to the private sector.
Yeah. And the best part of that is too, is now you have these private entities doing it, which we all know when you leave the government up to something, it's not going to be that great. Where if you let these private entities and companies or people and investors go out there and do it, you're going to get a better end product. You're going to get a better, more livable apartment or home versus the government doing it themselves. Because let's face it, they're trying to save as much money as possible while doing what they do. That's a huge point. Definitely appreciate that. Okay, cool. So I want to shift focus a little bit and talk about, besides just the tax piece of it, what else can you do to hedge against the inflation? Like we talked a little bit about gold and silver. What are some other ways? Like, actually, I want to ask you how you feel about this, because I know you like to focus on hard assets. How do you feel? Because like right now, I-bonds, for example, are over 9%, I think, going now until October. So at the time of this recording, it's over 9% to buy I-bonds. How do you feel about something like that, which it's government subsidized?
We'll get back to the show after a brief break.
What's going on, everybody? So today I want to talk to you about WealthTender. If you are a finance content creator, whether that's a blog, a podcast, you're a financial advisor or a financial coach, I highly recommend you check out WealthTender. WealthTender is building a database of all the top finance blogs, podcasts, and the financial advisors and financial coaches that they have on there are vetted and top-notch. So we actually had the pleasure of hosting Brian Thorpe, the CEO and founder of WealthTender, on Average Joe Finance's podcast, episode 25. Go check out that episode, listen to his story, and listen to him talk about the database that he's building. It's really phenomenal stuff. So if you're interested in checking out the directory, or if you're a finance content creator and you're interested in joining up with the directory, go to the link below in the show notes, or check out www.averagejoefinances.com/wealthtender.
What if I told you that you could be debt-free in 5 to 7 years? Hey, it's Mike Cavagione with the Average Joe Finances Podcast, and I partnered with the Shred Method to help you pay off your mortgage fast. I personally used this method and was able to invest in 2 large multifamily apartment deals, pay off almost $30,000 in home renovation debt, and pay down a large chunk of my mortgage all within 3 months. I am confident in the Shred Method because it works. Did you know that you can eliminate your mortgage with the power of a simple tool called a HELOC? You can learn more about all of this at theshredmethod.com/averagejoefinances. And if you use that link, you're going to save $200 off of your initial cost. Again, this is something that I know works because I use it myself. And that's www.theshredmethod.com/averagejoefinances. Or just click that link below. Let's get back to today's episode.
Yeah. So I think for investing in anything, it comes down to, for me, like it comes down to 6 different points. So the word investing at its root, it actually, the etymology, that word means to clothe your capital, right? So it's literally like you're putting clothing on your money. And so I just think common sense. I grew up in Alaska. I'm a common sense guy. So when I wear clothing, if I clothe myself, I'm not going to wear things that I don't like. I'm not going to wear things that I don't understand. I'm not going to wear things that don't fit me as a person. I'm not going to wear things that don't fit the occasion that I'm going to be using them for. I'm going to wear vital clothing first, and then I'm also not going to overpay for clothing. And so the same rules would apply with my investing. If I don't like an investment, if I don't understand it, if it doesn't fit me as an individual, if it doesn't fit my goals, if it's not vital, like if it's not tied to something valuable that people are going to continue to pay for, whether the economy is up or down. And then lastly, is that I'm not going to overpay. And so everything I do, I run through that filter. I don't like not having control. So I don't like digital and paper assets for that reason. And so it doesn't matter how big of a yield you wave in front of me. I can't check off that first box of I like it. And then because I'm not in control of it, there's always going to be some missing level of understanding. Unless they're fully disclosing to me all of the books and all of the financials behind everything, I'm always going to be the odd man out on that kind of investment. And so I might be able to say I understand, but do I really? And so that's where something like real estate, I can dive into a P&L. A life insurance company, they disclose their profit and losses on their website every year. I can look at that. And so that's a big part for me, is those 2 boxes would have to be checked. And I don't think I could do that on a bond like that.
Wow. I just want to say that analogy, right, of clothing your capital. Absolutely love that, man, especially the way you tie it in. You're not going to buy clothes. You have to buy clothes suitable for the situation. So when you were living in Alaska, you needed something that was going to keep you warm, right? Versus where you live at in Florida. Right? Yeah, exactly. So that is super awesome. Like when you tie it to something like that, and then you're not going to buy something that you're not interested in or that you don't like, because if it's not something you're going to be passionate about, it's not something you're going to care too much about, there's a lot of room for error right there. You don't want to go out to the store and mismatch clothes and then people looking at you all funny. So there's that aspect. And then also it's about dressing for the environment that you're in. So when the way you describe that, man, I absolutely love that, Jerry. That is fantastic for sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, man. I'm going to use that in the future for sure. I'm just letting you know.
Go for it.
Somebody brings that up and be like, hey, let me tell you about what Jerry said. Okay.
It'll help a lot of people.
Yeah. That is super cool, man. All right, I want to kind of transition to this part of the podcast that we call the final round, okay? I'm going to ask you some hard-hitting questions, 3 hard-hitting questions, and then an opinion-based piece, and then we'll go from there, okay?
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. All right, so the first question I have for you, Jerry, okay, with everything that you've had and that you've experienced from being on the traditional or the mainstream side to where you're at now with alternative investments and building wealth like the top 1%, what would you say is the biggest mistake you've ever made?
The biggest mistake that I ever made was not checking where the information I got, where it came from, and if it was valid. And I say that because I was an actual financial advisor. I took actual series exams with the state government, federal government, and that's quote unquote gospel. That's the right information. But I never looked at, well, do wealthy people use this? Right? Let me see a practical example. And so I bought into that for several years and I was at the top of the top. Most people don't have those licenses and they buy into it. And so I would say, if I would have just asked that question, is okay, good, I learned this. Where is it? Where is the example of this with a wealthy person in the real world? I think I would have switched over much sooner.
Wow. Yeah, that's a fantastic point. Definitely appreciate that answer. Okay. And this is going to tie into the next question I'm going to ask you. And what is something that you've learned over the years that you wish you knew when you first got started?
Man, that's a great one. So one of my favorite things I've ever learned, there was a chart that was shown to me back in 2016 or 2017. It showed the savings rate by wealth class. And so it showed like the top 1%, like the next 10% spread, and then the bottom 90%. And this stuck with me as soon as I saw it. For 100 years, it went back from 1913 until 2013, I think, or 2016. The top 1% saved 40% of their gross income, 40%. And it was like clockwork. During the up economies, they're saving 40. And then the Great Depression, the 1950s, those recessions and depressions, their savings rate would drop. And you could actually see where they were in good times stacking it away, building liquidity. And then in bad times, they were going in and they're buying everything. So that stuck with me. And when I learned that, was like, if I knew nothing else, I need to go save 40% of my income. And that was for me the linchpin of, okay, this is how you get into the top 1% of wealth.
Wow, that's significant. 40%, that could be tough for a lot of people to do, but you can get there.
For sure,
that's a great way to stay focused and disciplined, but you can reap the rewards later on as those opportunities present themselves. So it definitely gives you more liquidity for opportunities in the future. That's for sure.
It does. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So this, again, is going to tie into the next question. And so you shared something that you learned that you wish you knew when you first started. But what about, do you have any tips or tricks that you would recommend to someone that is just getting started today?
So if you're just getting started today, I used to be a personal trainer. I've done bodybuilding since I was like 16. Make finances a daily habit. Like I related to when I would go to the gym, like you're not going to get in perfect shape in 3 weeks. It's got to be a daily thing. So with my clients, we have this thing called the Big Three Challenge. And so it's a triangle. You check off one point of the triangle and try and do all three of them every day. The first one is every day you want to learn something about money. Spend 10 minutes, go on Investopedia, watch a YouTube, whatever it is, do something to increase your financial literacy. The second point is every day, do something to earn more income. You're already working, but we're saying do an extra, like something extra to earn more income. And then third is reconcile and rate your transactions, paying attention to where the money is going. And that's something I'd say if you're just now starting, do that big three. If you do that every day for 90 days, it'll become a habit. Then it's just on automatic. And that behavior will take you so far.
Yeah, wow, Jerry, that is a fantastic point and a great tip for somebody that is just getting started today. Do that for 90 days and it'll become a habit. It'll just become second nature and just something that you put into your routine and do every day. I like how you tie when you first started off as a bodybuilder and doing as a physical fitness instructor and things like that, as a coach, right? How you're able to tie that into finances and how like these different things can go hand in hand and why it's super important that these things are, you know, or what makes them similar is your mindset, right? It's how you look at it and how you think about it, how you mm-hmm. treat it, and also your relationship with it, right? You can't just go into it saying, oh, I'm going to do A, B, C, and D, but I'm going to get to that later. That's like me. Yeah. Like when I say, oh, I'm going to go for a run, I'll go later this afternoon when I'm done with everything.
Sometime.
And then when I'm done with everything, I'm like, I'm tired right now, not really feeling like it. So it's the things like that can break you out of that habit. So you got to stay disciplined and stay focused and stay on track. So that's huge, man. Absolutely. All right. So the final question I have, this is more of an opinion piece, but you're pretty well versed in this stuff. So obviously you get some great information, some great content from somewhere. So you're also absorbing stuff yourself. So do you have a favorite business, investing, or real estate related book or podcast or both?
Yeah. So like I said, I did a lot of biographies. So I wouldn't say I have one particular book. This might be a cheating answer, but I tell people, like, go learn about old dead people. Go read from guys like Rockefeller and Carnegie and their biographies, because you can just dive into the data. One of the best books I read was Gospel of Wealth by Andrew Carnegie. I'd say that would maybe be my answer. At one point, the richest man in the United States, and he died penniless because he gave literally all of it away. And before he was wealthy, he stated that's what he was going to do. He said, I'm going to become the wealthiest guy in the world and give it every penny of it away. So when you see that, like, setting the goal, and then you can see how he did it all and how he built it, and then actually followed through on the plan. Like that for me was just beautiful. That's the goal for what I would hope everyone could do.
Wow. Yeah, Jerry, that is great recommendation. Wrote that one down too. Gospel of Wealth. Definitely go check that out. That one's getting added to my list as well. But yeah, that's a great point. Go read the bios of the old dead people that have come and gone, but have done amazing things during their time here on earth. Okay, great. So this was fantastic. That's the end of the final round. I really appreciate your answers. This has been an absolutely awesome interview, man. But I have one more question for you. And this one's really important because the people that have been listening to this show are like, man, I really like what Jerry's talking about, everything that he's all about. I want to learn more about him and the content he's putting out. If you could share with us, where can people find you? Do you have a website you could share with us? Any social media accounts or anything like that?
Yeah, so we're everywhere. I'll go ahead and give you on Instagram. So that's probably where I'm the most active. If you follow me on Instagram, just at Jerry Fetta, my first and last name. If you go to our site, I actually wrote a book about 2 years ago, and I can give you a free copy. This is called Blueprint to Financial Freedom. And maybe Mike could drop this in the show notes. If you go to jerryfetta.com/B2F, so it's B, the letter two, and then F, sorry, the number two, and then F, promo, and then you can get a free copy of the book. We've got a ton of free articles and blogs and different things on the website as well.
Yeah, fantastic. So I will definitely have all those links in the show notes to make it easier for people to find you guys and to find you, Jerry, but also to find the Wealth Dynamics and everything that you guys are all about, because this is really good stuff, man. And I'm definitely going to go follow you on Instagram as well and absorb some of this awesome content that you're putting out, because that's what it's all about, man. I'm also a content sponge, especially when it's good information. I love to go out there and absorb as much as I possibly can. Definitely appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today, especially with the time difference. I know it's getting a little later there, even though you still got some sunlight, but I definitely appreciate you taking some time to chat with me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right, brother. Aloha. Thank you for making it to the end of this episode. Greatly appreciate you being here with me today on the Average Joe Finances podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make this the episode that you go leave us a 5-star rating or subscribe to our YouTube channel. The Average Joe Finances podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Have an outstanding day.
Thanks for listening to the Average Joe Finances podcast, your source for beating debt, saving money, and investing. Learn more at averagejoefinances.com.